T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.
We are so far off the menu this week. We are way into the past. And you know I love this kind of stuff. So do you want to talk about Benjamin Franklin? Yeah, that one, the real Ben Franklin, founding father. When he wasn't messing around writing the Declaration of Independence, he was such an interesting character. I did not know so much. I did not know that when he was a kid, Boston was like a little swampy town of 10,000 people where teenagers are just, you know, running around in the woods, finding frogs to cook. I learned these things because I have been reading Stirring the Pot with Benjamin Franklin, A Founding Father's Culinary Adventures by Ray Catherine Amy. And she is somewhat one of those historians that finds a way to make everything fresh by doing what I really care about, finding out what people ate. So we're going to just talk about the way, way past. Ray, Catherine, Amy, welcome to the show.
Thank you. And thank you so much for those kind words. It really is a treat to talk to you, but also to have cooked Ben's foods for the last couple of years.
Oh, so let's, I don't even know where to start with all of this. I mean, Ben Franklin is one of those people who, you know, he's so in the culture, like he's got a key on a thing and he's out there discovering electricity. And then he's coming up with all kind of slogans for us to learn how to, you know, work all the time and the Porter's Almanac. But he was more than that. He like had this very interesting life. I'm not exactly sure where to even start, but let's just start at the very beginning, because I was fascinated when he was born and, you know, growing up in Boston. It was not Boston of the Big Dig and what we think of today.
Oh, heavens no, no. It was a much smaller community, but it was a large community for the American colonies. So, and it was really very sophisticated. His house was on a hill overlooking the harbor. And he, you know, like any boy, he didn't have to work until he was 12. And so he could go hang around the harbor. He could watch the ships being loaded and offloaded. He could see all of the foodstuffs coming from around the world and just from across the bay.
And he was a working class kid. He was not to the manor born. His dad had a job that's a very, to me, interesting job.
Yeah, the family owned a candle shop. So Franklin worked in the candlery, helping melt the tallow. Beef tallow was what the candles were made out of. Melt that tallow down, dip some wicking into it at the end of the day. When you couldn't dip it anymore because it wasn't deep enough, you would pour the remainder off into molds. He was one of the leading candle makers in Boston.
And when I think of candle making today, I have a very like ridiculous 21st century idea of just a bunch of candles on a shelf that you got out of a box. But this is not, like, we're talking, he got beef tallow and then they would put it in these enormous cauldrons. And then you did a home version of this, yeah, where you just sit there and dip it once. And
I did. I was very fortunate to have a friend who, raises beef, and she rendered some of her beef tallow for me. So it was grass-fed beef, the kind that Franklin would have used, and was kind enough to bring me a quart mason jar, and I melted it and was able to make about 6 dipped candles that were 10 inches long and 4 molded candles that I did in those little teeny Dixie cups, bonus size. And it's amazing. I had thought that there would be an aroma, you know, that there might be something off-putting. There isn't. Well-rendered tallow has no odor. And they burn with this beautiful golden light. It's just amazing.
And they burn continuously. If the sun was not out and you want to do anything, you needed a candle.
Precisely.
And so you have a calculation in your book, which is I thought was astonishing, is how many candles like a colonial American would need to get through their day, and then how many candles Ben Franklin's dad would have to make or have to.
Yeah, it really is. You know, it was a lot of math, and it gave me a sense of how much money they could make and how successful he could be. And it you know, when looking at that, you see that although it was a working class household, Franklin's father was well educated. He and he was a member of the Puritan Church, and so he was meeting with upper class people, you know, preachers and members of society. He also was looked upon as a man of good common sense. So community leaders would come to Franklin's father, Josiah, sit around the big dining table. They had more candlesticks and more candles than anybody else, as you can imagine. they also had, when I looked at the what he left behind in his will, they had 16 chafing dishes, and I'm going, well, why on earth would you need 16? Well, then you start to look at the colonial foodways and the chafing dish recipes, and you're sitting in a house that has no central heating, of course, so people are hard by the hearth, and to keep food warm, everybody would have their own little chafing dish. So you could, you know, carry on conversation and have, you know, warm food to eat over a space of hours.
That's fascinating. How big were these individual chafing dishes?
It's kind of hard to tell. They didn't describe them in the inventory of Josiah Franklin's estate, but there are some in museums, and the basins are a little bit smaller than what my mother-in-law's one was, which was about 12 inches. So they're, you know, between 5 and 6 to 8 to 10.
Oh, so just like a regular dinner plate.
Yeah, yeah, exactly, exactly, with a little heat underneath.
Oh, that kind of sounds kind of good. I think
yeah,
I would like
doesn't
that.
It? Doesn't it? And there's a fish recipe in the book that has this really great horseradish sauce that's just divine, cooked in the chafing dish.
I like the idea of that. Okay, so then he was kind of a rebel, right? He was a rebellious teenager. The family had a hard time finding a good fit for him and ended up, well, you tell the story.
Right, right. His father, you know, was, of course, a youth of that age, needed to be apprenticed. He could have gone to continuing school. He did 2 years of formal schooling, but in those days, if you went to school, where you ended up was at Harvard, and you ended up being a minister. That was the only course of occupation, and they knew that that wouldn't be a good fit for Ben. So Josiah took him around looking for places for him to fit, and the only one that really seemed sensible was to work for his brother to learn the printing business. And so he was to be apprenticed to his brother from the age of 12 until the age of 21, which is a really long apprenticeship period. But by the time he was 17, Ben said, well, enough of this, and ran away and ended up in first New York and then Philadelphia.
And running away, you know, you think now, like, oh, I'm going to get on the bus. But no, it was not that easy.
No, he had to get on a ship, and he had sold some of his books, you know, one of his important possessions to buy to raise the fare to get on this boat, and he ended up in Philadelphia. And it turned out that the printing trade was the absolute perfect one for him because it was his lifelong, not only occupation, but avocation. He set up a printing press when he was in Paris as the leading diplomat for the American New Nation, and printed special forms. And then when he came back to Philadelphia, he still kind of dabbled in it and set his grandson up as a printer as well.
And then, of course, there's, you know, in Philadelphia, his esteemed printing career, right?
Yeah. He was a very clever businessman, too. It wasn't, you know, just that he knew how to do the technical part of the printing, at which he was really good. He was so good, he devised printing plates to make counterfeit-proof money. So he printed money for paper bills for the colony of New Jersey and the colony of Delaware. But he had a saying in Poor Richard's Almanac, which is, if you take care of your business, it will take care of you. Mm-hmm. So he worked essentially for 18 years as a printer. And by that time, he had amassed enough money that he could retire. And he thought he would then at that point just become, you know, a scientist and, you know, a man of leisure. And then the city people came around, the city fathers came around and said, well, you know, you're really too good to just be, you know, figuring out how electricity works. We really need you to help us work to make the colony be all that it could be. So then he ends up going to London for 15 years.
That was a long time, and it was a fractious time. So obviously, the United States and England had some troubles leading up to the revolution. And that whole time, almost the whole time, Ben Franklin is the American who's our top guy over there.
Yeah, he went as a lobbyist to kind of make the case for the Pennsylvania colony to the leaders in England, and you know the Penn family, of course, and the other rulers. And as you said, it got kind of fractious. But what kept him sort of on an even keel was, in addition to going to social clubs and scientific clubs to meet with the men who had read of his scientific experiments with electricity and helped publish them, but his wife Deborah sent him food from home. She sent him smoked meats, the barrels of pickled sturgeons, barrels of cranberries, which they didn't know in England at all, and his landlady's cooks sort of looked at it and sort of didn't know what to do with them. But eventually they all figured out how to make really great cranberry tarts, and we have a really good cranberry tart recipe in the book, too. It's just fabulous. The really nice thing about that recipe, you can make that filling, mm-hmm. and it'll keep in the fridge, you know, for weeks, and when you want just a little tart, you can just make one little one.
So it's just, I'll tell the listeners, it's basically just cranberries, brown sugar, and mace and cinnamon, I think.
Yeah.
And so it's a very, very simple, I like this idea of all the fancy people of England in the 1700s coming around to Ben Franklin's to get that exotic cranberry tart that nobody else had.
Right, right. And the other important thing she sent him was corn. And that kind of fits into his political thinking, because he recognized that corn was the essential American grain. And so he went through the Stamp Act period, which was extremely fractious, when England was literally taxing every single piece of paper that was used in the colonies. I mean, you write a will, there's a tax. You print a newspaper, there's a tax. He engaged in a dialogue with editors of the newspaper.
Paper was hard to make at first. Like, this is a little thing that we take for granted now. You think, oh, I'll just go to Target and get a couple of reams of it. But it was made from rags.
Rags, which was another part of his business success. He bought rags from people when he owned the printing shop and then sold them to the papermaking company. And he ended up controlling a large percentage of the paper product in the colony. But this is before the Stamp Act. So after this, as the Stamp Act is going on, he's writing these letters to the editor in London saying, you know, you can't understand the colonies if you can't value our essential grain. So he uses corn, Indian corn, maize, as a metaphor for the virtues of American life. And he says, you know, sort of suggests that they're all sissies if they eat things like, you know, wheat-made Yorkshire muffins and whatnot. You know, that if you can't understand how this is wholesome and sturdy and valuable, how can you understand who we are as a people?
Yeah, it's a lot of food kind of threads through his life. And so you talked in the book about how he was, you know, in his London years, going through something like 9,000 pounds of beef a year. So obviously.
Well, that was in Paris.
Oh, that was in Paris.
That was in Paris, where we have the advantage of 1 year's journal of everything that went into his kitchen. So it was like, and he was the leading diplomat for, at that point, the emerging nation. And his job was.
Okay, I should clarify for the listener. So he was in Paris before all of this and during the French and Indian War.
Nope. I clearly didn't do my job well enough.
Oh, no. Well, I'm not.
No. He's in Paris. He's in America during the French and Indian War, which is the 1850s. There's 1750s, and you've got me. It's a long time ago, as you said. So in the 1750s, there's the French and Indian War, and then he goes to London as the leading lobbyist for the American colonies. It all falls apart. He comes home in 1775, sticks around for a year, helps write the Declaration of Independence, and the fall after the Declaration is written and signed in July of 1776, he's sent to Paris. And he's sent to Paris because the United States doesn't have any money, can't make its own gunpowder, doesn't have enough soldiers, needs support to conduct the revolution, to survive as a nation. So they appealed to the longest adversary of the English crown, the French crown.
Ah.
So he's over there being this rustic-looking American in this little fur cap. He doesn't wear a wig. He eats asparagus with his fingers. Oh, my gosh. How horrible, you know, they're... But that was part of the appearance he wanted to present, that here's this humble man from a humble country that needs help. So,
oh, interesting. So he's in crafty table manners to
especially very crafty man, very clever, very smart. And so we have the peace treaty begins to be written in 1783. And so we have the household journal from that year. So he's doing a lot of entertaining. We have no idea how many people are there, but it's, you know, I did a spreadsheet analysis of what all was going into the kitchen. And what you see is this drive for eating fresh food, for eating farm to fork. As we pass through the seasons, more and more fresh seasonable foods come in. But it is, you know, 9,000 pounds of beef.
That's a lot of mouths to feed.
It is. Well, yeah. And there was essentially a chicken every day. There were 2,330 apples. Apples were Franklin's favorite fruit.
And so it was just this party. Just this party of getting French money to help us, right? Is that what it was?
Yeah, it was essential. Without the French help, we would not have survived as an independent nation. It wouldn't have happened.
That's so funny because the image that passed down to me, you know, just sort of cultural osmosis, was Ben Franklin, Poor Richard's Almanac, like we're all thrifty in a corner with a wood stove.
Which is true,
but not the other half of it was that he was partying hard for the country.
It's partying strategically. John Adams sort of looked askew at the people who were driving up to Franklin's estate, which was just about 13 miles outside of Paris proper. And, you know, Adams had that same thought the way you just expressed it. You know, he's partying. But then when you read Franklin's letters, he's going, oh, I wish these people wouldn't come. I'm so exhausted. You know, go away. But he knew he needed to engage with them to keep the money flowing.
Well, it worked. So.
Yes, it did.
And then all, you know, in all of it, and he kind of came through, he led his whole life with a belief in the value of these practical arts, cooking and economy and, you know, running things in the house. And you talk about how the University of Pennsylvania was kind of founded with some of these ideas.
Right. He felt, as you were just saying, you know, that it was important for young people to learn and to learn a balanced education, not just the way they were learning at Harvard, you know, Latin and Greek, which he knew, but he thought it was important for people to have both the practical sense and the academic sense. So he made it part of the chartering document for the institution, which many years later would become the University of Pennsylvania, that people learn practical skills too, and he suggested among them be things like gardening.
Yeah, and it's, of course, so a lot has been written about, you know, plants and his interest in that. But I will gloss over that. People should go get the book if you want the detail on the garden. I've got Carol Henderson here. This is his last official DNR showing he is retiring on Tuesday after 45 years. I could devote an entire weekend, I think, to Carol Henderson stories. You're wondering who went to Alaska and got us trumpeter swan eggs so we could rebuild the trumpeter swan population. That'd be Carol Henderson. He has been the non-game wildlife program supervisor for the Minnesota DNR for a long time, and he's been working there for 45 years. Do you have questions about lead shot, lead bullets, lead in your venison? Text us, 81807. Carol, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate being here.
So on behalf of all Minnesotans who like trumpeter swans, thank you. Oh. I was walking around Cedar Lake, just being my urban self last fall, and there were a bunch of trumpeter swans. I was shocked. I was like, right here, right off 394 in the middle of the city?
Oh, yes. They're just an absolutely wonderful, inspiring bird. And we released 370-plus swans back in the late 1980s. And now we have over 20,000 swans in the state, and they're expanding to new marshes everywhere. And they're so exciting for people to enjoy.
They're so big.
Yes. They weigh up to 35 pounds. They're the biggest waterfowl in the world.
They look like they weigh much more than 35 pounds. They're wings, and then they're so big. They're so noble. They're just astonishing to see.
Yeah, they're on the same level as bald eagles in terms of inspiration.
Yeah, and so you've got to feel, I want a career like yours. You look back after 45 years and you think, I did good. I made change in the world. Like,
oh,
that's you.
Yeah, it's been a wonderful career and worked with a lot of wonderful people along the way.
Yeah, I bet. And so you saw it all. You saw the raptor populations crash. You saw with the DDT and the different pesticide use, you saw the rebound.
Yes, we've watched this from the early stages when eagles in Minnesota were coming back. And then we captured eagle chicks just ready to leave their nest back in the early 90s and donated 5 eagles per year to places like New York, Missouri, Arkansas, North Carolina, Georgia to help them restart their eagle populations. And now they're doing well throughout much of the East with Minnesota eagles.
Minnesota eagles. I didn't know that. Are you serious? We got Minnesota eagles that were helping out in New York and all over the East Coast? Yeah. All right, there. More things to feel proud and excited about. But this is what we're here to talk about today. You emailed me and you were like, we need to talk about lead shot in food. I had no idea that this was happening. So why don't you break it down? You and the wonderful people at the DNR have been x-raying. Can you explain?
Yes. Well, we've found over the years working with the Raptor Center at the University of Minnesota that there's been a long-term problem with eagle deaths in Minnesota because they were dying of lead poisoning. And one of the things we were looking at is that the timing that they just determined is that most of the eagles were dying during and after the fall deer season. And it related to the fact that the eagles were eating the refuse from the processed deer. When they got the deer in the woods, the eagles eat the refuse.
All right, I don't know if we're allowed to say gut piles on the radio, but that's where we're going there. Maybe
entrails.
Entrails. All right, so when you, obviously everybody knows you kill a deer in the field, you need to process it.
Field dress it,
You need to field dress it so that it doesn't, you know, go bad. Like, this is just standard practice. You leave those in the woods, and you showed me a picture that blew my mind.
Yes, the eagles come in, and they'll eat this, and it's not just one eagle. There might be 4, 5, 6 eagles all fighting over that one pile of free food. And the eagles even respond to the sound of gunfire to go find where that is. And
I did not know this. I did not know that an eagle hears a gunshot and is like, I got to go see what that's about. I'm going toward the gun. Really?
Yes. And actually, we've had reports like from Pat Reddick's nephew from the Raptor Center that the eagle will follow the hunters out into the woods and wait for the hunter to shoot the deer.
Really?
So they are a smart bird. But it gets them into trouble. So my interest in this started with looking after eagles and trying to figure out how we can reduce eagle mortality.
So this is the proverbial canary in the coal mine.
Yes.
But it's the eagle in the gut pile.
It's the gut pile problem. and so we looked at what was going on. But all of the major ammo manufacturers have switched over to producing non-toxic copper ammunition for deer hunting.
Okay, but wait, let's just keep going with this. So you found all of these eagles were dying because of the gut piles.
Yes.
And then a light bulb went off in your head and you said, well, if the shot is making it all the way into the entrails, it is also in the muscle.
Yes, and the Department of Natural Resources Section of Wildlife did a study back in 2008-2009 where they did a research project shooting into dead sheep to see how does the bullet splinter when it hits. because that would be simpler, similar in shape and conformation to a deer. And the little lead fragments from a bullet, they splinter out and they go up to 12, 14 inches away from the wound channel and become embedded in the meat. And so it's not just eagles anymore, because we're saying, okay, people are bringing this home in their venison.
And so you did this study where you looked at, so a lot of people donate meat to food shelves, and that's fantastic. And then the DNR x-rayed them and found, and this is where my jaw just fell to the ground, you found that 15% of the meat that was being donated had these lead fragments in it. You right. extrapolate, this means that people that are eating venison, like 15% of them are eating lead. And people, if you don't know, lead is poison. It is really bad for you. It will damage your brain. It damages young brains. It'll make you dumb. It'll give you neurological problems. You do not want to be eating lead. And so we are here to say, everybody, it's got to switch to copper shot right away.
Right. And it's a simple change. The prices are about the same. They're actually more effective, more accurate. There are people who have practiced with copper ammo and gotten a group of it at 300 yards, an inch and a half in a circle. It's very accurate.
So it's a better bullet.
It's a better bullet.
And it's not going to poison you. And this is when I need everybody who's listening to go be a busybody. Your lovely, you know, your wonderful uncle who gives you venison, your great cousin. I mean, just be like, this is not like me, but I got to ask, you know, and just we need to switch everybody. We need to spread the word, because I cannot have my people being lead poisoned. This is not okay.
Right. And it's one of those things where it's not going to kill you, but it's going to degrade your abilities. For older people, it might be cognitive abilities. For children, it can actually reduce their IQ. It's not recommended for expectant mothers. All of these things are negatives, and it's easily changed. And the price of the copper ammo is comparable now, about $1.50 to $2 per shell. And a good hunter isn't going to use more than 4 or 5 shots per season. So you're not looking at even hardly $10 for the cost of your shells.
Yeah, so this is just, we got to spread the word. And I saw these numbers about 15% of the venison that you're seeing is got lead shots, you know, just like through it. And I think we're just extrapolating, nothing better than pheasant in the fall, right? I mean, but everybody knows, you know, when you're eating pheasant that somebody shot, you know, don't chew down too hard because there's probably shot in there. That also needs to not be lead.
Yeah, and the non-toxic shot shells on upland areas, those pellets fall on the ground and they get subsequently eaten by a number of birds that pick up the pellets as seeds. They think they're seeds. So any way we can reduce the release of lead into the environment.
And it's all going to get down into the water if it just lies there. And so what the operative word, the words we're looking for are non-toxic shells, right?
Yes, non-toxic. Some of them are going to be copper or copper composites, maybe with zinc. For shot shells, upland hunting, look for tungsten or bismuth types of shells. There also are some tin types of shells. But when I looked at the deer hunting, last year we had 500,000 deer hunters. They took about 200,000 deer. Average deer, about 40 pounds of venison. If you look at 15% of that venison, this 8 million pounds of venison harvested in Minnesota last year. 15% would be 1.2 million pounds of lead-tainted venison that people ate this past year. That's not smart. That's not good.
No, and there's no benefit. There's no benefit to lead. You're not like, oh, I got to get my USDA amount of lead. It's really bad.
The most important byline here is that this is not a criticism of hunting. I mean,
not at all.
This is a wonderful tradition in Minnesota, and it's something we really care about. But it's just about how we hunt as a responsible person.
No, nor was switching from you know, lead paint to latex paint. That was not a criticism of painting. This is just a better practice. So
We don't want those unintended consequences that continue after the deer season.
No, absolutely not. We do not want lead in our blood. We're against it. This is not a radical proposition. This is not, I wouldn't think, a partisan issue. Anybody who wants lead in their blood is a... maybe already has lead in their blood because they're not thinking straight. It's a terrible thing to happen to your nervous system. You don't want it.
No, and we don't want to feed that to our children and our grandchildren and our friends, anybody.
No.
It's deleterious to everything.
All right, so Carol Henderson. So you've had this fascinating life where you've helped Minnesota in all these ways. You brought back Eagles. Now they're letting us know that we have poison in our blood supply. That's an unusual twist of events. Thank you, Eagles, for alerting us to this bad situation. And I don't know if you're allowed to talk about this, but you're also looking at toxic sinkers and
yes. Within the next few days, there should be a publication in the Federal Register about a plan that we have submitted to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, because the BP oil spill back in 2010 caused impacts on loons that were wintering in the Gulf of Mexico. And so we submitted a plan for loon conservation for Minnesota. We were the only northern state that applied for funding, and they're going to be announcing this probably Monday or Tuesday, very, very soon. And part of that package will be to promote the use of non-toxic jigs and sinkers, the tiny ones, like split shot and the little jigs. There are a number of Minnesota manufacturers, many of them up in the Brainerd area. They're already making this, but it's sometimes hard to find them in the sporting goods stores. You need to ask for it.
Okay, we need to buy non-toxic
jigs and sinkers. They're made of tungsten or bismuth.
Right, because that's going to end up in your food, too, because you go fishing, then you're going to eat the fish. This is not good.
Well, it's not so much a problem with people eating it, but loons, when they dive to the bottom, they pick up little pebbles to grind up the minnows they eat. But if they pick up a lost jig or sinker, like a split shot, all it takes is one split shot to kill the loon. And we have dead loons that are turned in every year because they ate lead.
Ugh.
And so if you want to save the state bird, use non-toxic fishing tackle. If you want to save the national bird, the bald eagle, use non-toxic ammo for deer hunting.
And you want to save yourself.
Yes, and yourself.
This is just a basic self-preservation. Stop eating lead. There,
yeah.
I'm just radical. I'm coming out. We do not want. And so, of course, people are going to ask when I see, venison jerky in the grocery store, is this what we're talking about? That is not it. Venison that enters the food supply through commercial means, that is goes through the same process that, cows and chickens do. It's commercial slaughterhouse. There's no lead shot involved in that. So this is not applied to venison, your venison jerky that you're getting at the co-op. This applies to, people shooting. Firearm season starts in a month. This is for everybody who's like, I think I will buy some bullets so I can get this going. You gotta do the non-toxic thing. I do not want you to have lead poisoning. None of you.
No.
All of you. I want you to not have that.
And so the decision on what ammo to buy needs to be more of a family decision, because in the past, deer hunters basically just would buy what they've always used. And now they need to get some further input on these other consequences and look for the non-toxic, because they're really good. Most of the people I've talked to have said once they switched over to the copper ammo, they never switched back.
Right. All right. This is your homework, everyone. I'm not asking you to do small things. I want you to start talking about this to the hunters in your life. If you're a hunter, start talking about it to the other hunters in your life. We do not want anyone eating lead. That's in the past. Okay. Carol Henderson, I can't thank you enough. And on behalf of everybody, thank you for bringing back trumpeter swans and all the work you've done in Minnesota. You have made it a better place.
Oh, thank you so much. It's been a wonderful life and a really happy one. In terms of helping the environment and the wildlife all around us.
Dara here. All right. Let's see. Let's answer some of your questions. What are some of the questions I got? Oh, pertaining to the toddlers destroying wine glasses part of the segment, I got a question about wanting to upgrade summer wine glass scene. And what advice do I have? All right. So two things. Those plastic wine glasses that look like the top of a wine glass, those are not bad, but they have to be hand washed. And then at that point that you have to hand wash something, I'm not sure what you're even, why the plastic is the advantage. I mean, I know that it's so that it can get blown off the picnic table and bounce instead of break. So I actually think I like the glass, the ones that look like the top of the wine glass, but they're made of glass and they're a little heavy. And then I like those and they can go in the dishwasher. But another option is to just pop down to IKEA and they have some nice wine glasses for $1.99. And then if you break them, they're almost disposable. So I don't know. It's hard. It's hard to be a classy wine drinker in the summer. The reason I like the actual stems on the glasses is because it keeps it away from your hands. Your hand is hot. It's the summer. If you're holding the actual glass, the whole thing starts to get kind of steamy. I don't know. Those are my thoughts. I think for your backyard, make your backyard drinking good. I think, you know, the one thing about the stem with the wine glass is it kind of whole thing works together like a sail on a clipper ship. So it just catches the breeze and blows off the table. All right, I got one more question, then we'll take a break and come back and do some more. Brenda has asked me via the Facebook, what is the logic? Why are those pickles supposed to be good for you? What is the logic? Why is everyone with the lacto-fermented pickles? She didn't say that. She just said, why are pickles good for you? I think she means the whole sauerkraut, kimchi, lacto-fermented. Okay, so what do these words mean? So these pickles are being pickled not by the action of vinegar, but by the action of friendly bacteria. The friendly bacteria get into your microbiome and they help you out. They help you digest food. They perhaps crowd out bad bacteria. So this is the logic behind yogurt. This is the logic behind all of these kind of good ferments. So that's it. It's two things. It's supposed to help your digestion and crowd out the bad guys. So you're bringing in the good guys to crowd out the bad guys. And those are the two ideas behind all of these fermented foods that are so on trend. All right, you got more questions for me? Text me. We got the text line up, 81807, and I'll come back and I will answer those texts. Yes, Dara here. All right, I got a question on the text line. What's my favorite Minneapolis restaurant to eat at the bar? Oh, you know where I'm really feeling? St. Genevieve. St. Genevieve, it's right off 50th and Bryant. It's on Bryant, right off 50th, kind of by Lake Harriet, near the creek. And so many things I love about this place. First of all, it just looks like a million bucks. Second, it's got a great wine list, great champagne list, possibly the city's best champagne list. Like, it's up there. And then it's got just all kinds of good little snacks. But it's one of those places you sit there and you just feel like a million bucks. You feel like you're in this French bistro. It's the center of the world. A lot of people think you can't get into St. Genevieve, but I find that you can, though maybe I just ruined that. I've found it, you know, it's a little hard to get in there at like 7 o'clock on Friday, but at all other times and during the day, it's quite lovely. And it's got this kind of art deco, contemporary, white, Parisian feeling. It's so slick. I love it. But I feel like we get a little intimidated in the Twin Cities about getting into restaurants and thinking that they're harder to get into than they are. Somebody the other day was just like, I went to Spoon and Staple and I just got right in and I sat at the bar. It's like, yeah, you can do that. That's actually, you know, aside from that 6:30 to, you know, 7:45 on a Friday or Saturday, you can pretty much get in everywhere. We need to be less intimidated. All right, I got a question from somebody who wants to do some better grilling, and they want a one-stop. They don't want to have to run around and do stuff. You know what I love? Casetta's, downtown St. Paul. You can get sausages, and you can get, you know, everything. You can get the red sauce and the little appetizers for the side, your olives, everything. You can get a garlic bread in a tinfoil bag and just throw that whole thing into the grill. Yes, I like Casetta's very much.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.